may be seated. All right, our final case is 11-438, Kenneth Schwering versus TRW Vehicle Safety Systems. Counsel.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. May it please the Court. My name is Elizabeth Wright, and I represent the petitioner Ford Motor Company, along with Damon Mace, who represents the petitioner TRW. We would like to reserve 9 minutes for rebuttal. I will address the opening argument. We will share the rebuttal. Your Honor, we request that this Court answer Judge Beckwith's certified question, no, where a jury has been impaneled and sworn and trial has commenced for purposes of Rule 41A1. A subsequent mistrial does not permit the plaintiff to unilaterally, voluntarily dismiss his case without prejudice. This Court has addressed Rule 41 on a number of occasions, and on each and every occasion, the Court has steadfastly employed a strict construction analysis and relied upon the plain language of Rule 41. Rule 41, as written, provides the plaintiff with a very liberal right to dismiss without prejudice his case, regardless of reason or motivation, at any time before commencement of trial. But that before commencement of trial is clear and unambiguous and provides a very bright line in the rule. What it means is, after commencement of trial, the authority to determine if a case may be dismissed without prejudice shifts to the consent of the parties or to the trial judge.
What is the legal effect of a mistrial in your view, Ms. Wright?
Your Honor, the legal effect of a mistrial for purposes of Rule 41A has no effect because the rule has, you have to look at the plain language of the rule, which is commencement of trial. And as Judge Beckwith certified the question, she said, where the jury has been impaneled and sworn and trial has commenced. For purposes of generally a mistrial, it would allow the evidence taken to be used for substantive purposes or for impeachment purposes, and it would allow rulings of the trial judge to continue in his discretion.
So are you telling us that the evidence in a mistrial can be used in a subsequent proceeding?
It may be used either substantively or may be used for impeachment in either event.
And it would be your view, then, that the parties have become prejudiced because the trial strategies have been known and revealed either in opening statements or at some other point during the trial, and therefore there's an unfair advantage gained by permitting a violation of the rule, as you would say, to permit a dismissal without prejudice.
Yes, Your Honor. Among other things, trial strategies are certainly one of the prejudice afforded to the defendant by allowing a dismissal after a mistrial. In addition to the fact that trial strategy has been shown, as the commentaries say, there's been significant expense by the parties, and to allow a plaintiff who's dissatisfied with the jury he selected, with the testimony of his witnesses, or with the rulings of the trial judge to deliberately procure or provoke a mistrial or seek one himself would circumvent the rule.
Did you not join in the motion for a mistrial?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
So what was your purpose? Were you anticipating a retrial?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And the judge was about to set a retrial in this case when the plaintiffs voluntarily dismissed.
All right,
in a manner
you.
Not provided for by the rules. The rules have clear language, and each time this Court has looked at Rule 41, they've enforced the clear, unambiguous language. And here the language says, when a jury has been impaneled and sworn and trial has commenced. Now, the plaintiff can point to no language in Rule 41 that suggests trial has not commenced, and every Ohio appellate court that has looked at Rule 41 says it commences upon impaneling the jury and swearing them in. In this case, trial proceeded for several days. Judge Beckwith, in certifying her question, assumed for purposes of this question the trial had in fact commenced. The plaintiffs admit they can find nothing in the Rule 41 language and nothing in Ohio appellate court that allows them, after a mistrial, to dismiss without prejudice voluntarily.
What does your research show other state Supreme Courts have done in connection with dismissal after a mistrial?
Your Honor, very few states have addressed this, and when they've had, I think the ones that are cited by the plaintiff have rules that are different than Ohio. In no situation where there's a rule identical to Ohio have they addressed the issue of the effect of a mistrial. For example, if you look at some of the other states, Illinois, which was cited by the plaintiff, the Kilpatrick case, that rule actually requires that a motion be filed, and in Kilpatrick, a motion was filed. And, Your Honor, here, under Rule 41A2, the plaintiffs had recourse if they were unhappy and wanted to start over again. They could have prevailed upon Judge Niehaus to allow them to move to dismiss without prejudice. But in this particular case, because the language of Rule 41A is so very clear, they would have to have sought his approval. And because the trial judge, having sat through the trial, is in the best position at that point to weigh the equities, look at the prejudice to the parties, and to ensure the orderly administration of justice, is in a position to impose terms and conditions on a dismissal.
What's the federal rule?
The federal rule provides, Your Honor, you cannot dismiss after an answer has been filed. It is different than the Ohio rule, which requires that you can dismiss any time up until commencement of trial. So they are distinguished in that manner.
So if you file an amended answer, are you able to then dismiss before you file the amended answer?
You mean if an amended complaint is filed, Your Honor?
I'm sorry, amended. Well, you said before an answer is filed. Yes, an amended complaint. Yes, thank you.
If you file a complaint, no answer is filed, or a motion to dismiss is filed, the plaintiff could dismiss in federal court without prejudice. Once the answer is filed, even if you file an amended complaint, the original answer would still hold, and you could not dismiss without prejudice. You would need to seek the court intervention. Here, what the plaintiffs are asking is that this court take the plain language of Rule 41 and write an exception. And this court has said on numerous occasions that's the position of the Rules Committee, not this court. And you can look at Pattinson and Olenek and Fairchild and a whole host of cases where people have asked for an interpretation of the rule that is not in any way borne out by the plain language. What plaintiffs would ask this court to do here is to actually craft an exception that before...
Counsel, if you were to prevail here, what would the status be of the plaintiffs?
If the answer to the certified question here is no, which we believe it should be, the plaintiffs would go back to federal court and Judge Beckwith would rule on Ford and TRW's motions to dismiss the case with prejudice as having filed a dismissal which was not provided for by Rule 41. And in this particular case, there's nothing in Ohio law that allows the court to craft an exception. The reasons make sense here. The trial judge, having observed the trial, is in a position to know whether the plaintiff should be allowed to dismiss without prejudice. What we have here and why we're here today is the plaintiff made a series of tactical gambles, clear and deliberate, to avoid Judge Niehaus in state court. The judge was about to set another trial. He had told the plaintiffs his rulings on their experts were going to remain the same, so the plaintiff didn't want that trial. So the plaintiff had recourse. It wasn't draconian. He could have approached Judge Niehaus. He deliberately chose to circumvent 41A2 and avoid Judge Niehaus, who would have imposed terms and conditions, and instead filed a notice of dismissal without prejudice, which is not provided for by Rule 41. Having done that, it was improper, and the answer to the certified question is, under Ohio law, he did not have the right to do it. The effective you've asked for, Justice Kopp, and Justice O'Donnell, is that having done that, having filed a dismissal which is not provided for by the rules, it is under 41B3 a dismissal with prejudice as an adjudication on the merits. We'd like to reserve the balance of our time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Schlemmer.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor, members of the court. My name is Art Schlemmer. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Schwering, the appellee, along with the Honorable Richard Enan from Indiana. The issue of who caused the mistrial, in my opinion, is totally irrelevant to this court's decision. I would submit to you, however, that we have provided you with ample information that we did not cause this mistrial. The court ultimately granted the mistrial. To make a insidious insinuation that we were smart enough to figure out 2 weeks into a court proceeding how to manipulate a mistrial, I simply submit to you that I appreciate the compliment, but that I'm not quite that good. Having said that, however, Ford originally moved for a mistrial. The court denied it. The court then struck Mr. Meyer's testimony on a Friday afternoon. On Monday morning, I argued to the court after filing our motion for reinstatement successfully. The court overturned its decision, indicated that it would reinstate Mr. Meyer's testimony. At that time...
If we take your principle, I mean, we have to write law for other cases, not just the fact scenario, as you are well aware.
I understand.
You could have an entire trial go all the way up through even jury deliberation, and if a mistrial is declared, and as you say, the reason is immaterial, if a mistrial is declared under your theory, you could dismiss at that point and refile and have a dual run that whole case.
Well, yes, Your Honor.
And is it true, as the other side claims, that evidence that has been submitted in that case can be used substantively or for cross-examination in the new trial?
Yeah. Yes. But let me also just add to that, Judge. When the mistrial, Your Honor, when the mistrial is granted by the court, there is going to be a do-over, regardless of who caused it. There's going to be a new trial. Both sides.
You did not take advantage of B and ask the court to set any conditions or ask the court for permission for refiling. You believed you had the authority to do it on your own.
Correct. Okay. And I would submit to you, Judge, that we did do the research before we did it. And let me just make one point to you relative. I don't believe that the jurisdiction that we refiled in federal court is necessarily an issue either. But after the case was mistried by the court, the tortfeasor settled with our client, and therefore diversity was created. And very simply, the multi-district litigation in federal court has dealt with the Ford rollover cases a lot, and we quite frankly felt that that was a better forum for us at that point in time, because the very problem that caused a mistrial we didn't believe would be an issue in federal court. So I think it would be, in fact, a lack of good laureate on our part had we not looked at that at that point in time. But the issue that this court, I believe, must decide, and I believe that every other jurisdiction that's looked at it must decide, is what is the procedural result of a mistrial. And we believe that all of the law throughout the United States, and it has been, and we've cited it in numerous jurisdictions, has been that a mistrial is a nullity.
Well, Mr. Slimmer, the issue really isn't the effect of the mistrial. I think the issue is the effect of the dismissal. The voluntary dismissal, isn't it?
No, I would disagree, Judge.
It seems to me, if I understood the argument that was presented, it's an application of the language of Rule 41 that says, after trial commenced. And don't we have to make an interpretation of what that means in the context of Civil Rule 41?
I believe...
Or am I missing it?
Yeah, well, I'm not saying you're missing the second part of the equation, but the first part of the equation is, what is the procedural effect of a mistrial?
And so if we say that the procedural effect of a mistrial is a nullity.
Yes.
Is that what you think?
Yes.
And it's as if it didn't happen.
Correct.
Then what is the effect of the days of trial that you were there when the trial strategies and the positions of the parties became evident to the other?
Well, that happens in every mistrial, Your Honor. That's not something that's novel to this case. Every time there's a mistrial, that happens. And again...
Well, had you gone back with the original trial judge, I don't know that we'd be here. I think the issue arises because a new jurist has sent a question to us as to the effect of what that language means. After trial commenced.
Well, I would submit to you that we would be here, quite frankly, because Ford filed a motion immediately after we filed our 41A dismissal in state court, asking that it was improper and asking the court to then to dismiss the case with prejudice. So the same issue arose in state court initially as soon as we filed the Rule 41A, which, by the way, we didn't file until about 3 or 4 months after the motion for a mistrial was granted by the court that Ford had requested, which we joined in the second time they moved for it. And they moved for it the second time after the court reversed its original decision. But
did you have a new trial date in the original trial court?
We did not.
You did not.
And I go back to, if the mistrial creates a nullity, as if the first trial did not occur,
yes,
then procedurally there has been no trial. There's no trial setting. And then 41A is reinstated. If you look at the cases, which I'm sure you've read, and I don't have to recite them to you, that's what every other jurisdiction has found. And the key to that is, once the court creates a mistrial, the argument that you can't use prior testimony or ruling, that again is, in my opinion, a red herring, simply because in every trial that I'm involved in, there are pretrial motions, motions for summary judgments, motions for limine, all sorts of issues get resolved by the court that get to be used in trial. But plenty of cases in Ohio that this court, the Court of Appeals across the state, have recognized have had plaintiff's attorneys get up 10 minutes before the jury is to be impaneled, after a ruling by the court that they didn't like, walk down to the clerk's office, handwrite a 41A dismissal, hand it in, stamp it, go back to the trial judge and say, "Judge, this case has been dismissed. You no longer have jurisdiction. We're finished today." That happens all the time. Same scenario, in essence, except this is a case for first impression of this case. Judge Beckwith in the Southern District of Ohio.
How do we deal with the concern raised by the other side? You're denying that you're smart enough to do this, but there might be another attorney who doesn't like how the trial's going and does something to deliberately create a mistrial to provoke the dismissal so they can refile. How do we deal with that issue? Or is that something that just is a possibility if we rule in your favor?
I think that it is a possibility, but I would simply submit to you this, Judge. A court doesn't have to grant a mistrial if it believes somebody is purposely trying to create a problem.
Yeah, but if you say something so outrageous, or you have your client say something so outrageous, the other side's prejudiced, they're certainly going to want to seek it.
I would submit to you that happened in this case, relatively speaking, but it was done by the court, and it was so outrageous that the court said to the jury, "I'm striking all of Mr. Meyer's testimony. I'm ordering the bailiff to rip out your notes, tear them up, and throw them in the garbage can." That all happened with the jury sitting in the room looking at us going, "What did you possibly do to make the court that mad at you to do this?" And so after the court then reinstated the testimony and Ford moved for a mistrial again, we then joined because we thought that was so prejudiced to us that we couldn't overcome it. So I would say this to you. In every instance that a mistrial is granted, somebody has done something wrong. Somebody has done something that the court says, "You have so prejudiced this case, there's going to be a mistrial." Now, how does the court deal with that? In my experience, the court sanctions the lawyer. The court goes to the jury and says, "This is such an egregious act, I'm going to instruct you to disregard. I'm sanctioning counsel." There's lots of actions that can be done to effectually fix it by the court. In this case, that was brought up, and Judge Niehaus, who happens to be actually a good friend of mine, said, when we asked him, "Judge, we need to instruct the jury that this was a mistake," and he said, "You must be kidding me. I'm not going to tell this jury that I made a mistake, but I'm going to reinstate the testimony." Again, that issue, Your Honor, was handled in a derivative case of this shortly a week after this mistrial was had, where Ford, in a case in Dallas, Texas, advised the court there that Mr. Meyer's testimony had been stricken in Ohio because it was unscientific and unreliable, and argued that. And then the record from my case was submitted to that judge. He ruled that absolutely sanctioned Ford's counsel, said you can't possibly believe that this testimony was not reinstated, went back to the jury, instructed them that what you heard from Ford's counsel about Mr. Meyer's testimony being unreliable is incorrect, and fixed that and would not grant a mistrial in that case, and that's how it's handled. But I would submit to you that every time there's a mistrial, there's been some conduct by the court to grant a mistrial, happens all the time. The only thing that's different here and what happened and what was, and I'll be perfectly honest with you, was a decision made by counsel, is that given that the mistrial creates a nullity, we did the research. There was no case law in Ohio. We looked at other jurisdictions. We explained it to our client that we might be here today. And we said, we're going to 41A this case because the problem that we had with, in this case, with evidence that if we refiled it in federal court, the multi-district litigation would solve the problem. Our counsel that's very experienced in trying forward rollover cases indicated that they have never had the problem with somebody claiming surprise about Mr. Meyer's testimony in any federal court that he's testified in, which is numerous. So we made the, I'm sorry, Your Honor, we made the decision that we believe we are on solid legal ground to 41A the case because it was a nullity, and therefore we just refiled it in federal court. It would be no different than just refiling the case if we stayed in state court. Everybody's in the same position.
Mr. Schlemmer, if yes. I could just back you up. When you talk about the mistrial being a nullity, the idea of the mistrial, the effect, you know, there's no effect because the mistrial has occurred. But do you have cases that are actually saying that no trial even commenced? Because that's really what we're talking about here under A. It's the any time before commencement of trial. And the point is, there was a commencement of a trial. Its effect may have been a nullity. But the trial itself commenced, and there was testimony taken that, as everyone points out, can be used in a later trial. It seems to me that if you're concerned about the opportunity to dismiss, that because we have this strange animal of mistrial that we're talking about that is not specifically mentioned by the rule, that we ought to default to the rule that allows for the court to determine whether a dismissal should occur under certain conditions, because we have had an aborted trial.
I understand, Your Honor. Well, we cited a number of cases where that exact issue in other jurisdictions was decided by court of appeals and Supreme Courts of other states. They're all in our brief starting on page 3, and they all uniformly, every single one, said that a mistrial has the legal effect of no trial at all.
Is that for all purposes?
Yeah, well,
because we have to say, you know, there's a nullity as to the fact, the conclusion of the trial, yet certain things do survive a mistrial, such as the testimony, introduction of evidence, et cetera, which can be used. But, of course, that happens in discovery as well, so you can get a lot of times the same information
exactly.
In discovery. So that may not be determinative here. But the question is, you know, had a nullity commenced, you know, are we substituting, you know, the word trial or the word nullity for a trial here? Or is that the way we need to look at it?
Well, no, I think you need to look at it from a procedural standpoint because it is a procedural issue. Sworn testimony is sworn testimony. It doesn't go away. The trial transcript doesn't go away. Rulings of the court, just like pretrial motion rulings, don't go away. The real issue that all of the other jurisdictions so have
let me stop you right there. So are you saying that if you then had a subsequent trial, there would be no need to proceed on any questioned introduction of evidence, et cetera, because that had already been ruled on in the first trial that is now a pretrial, so you would just proceed with evidence and presume it's introduced?
I don't believe you can presume it's introduced, but the evidence doesn't go away. I would like to think Judge Beckwith would be happy to hear that, but no, I don't believe that when you start a new trial, in any case where there's been a mistrial, that you simply don't have to reintroduce the evidence. You have a new jury. They have to hear it.
So no, I don't mean that you don't have to, but you can do so with if someone objects to it, you say, you know, you're bound by the ruling of the prior trial. Is that
yep.
what your response would be if that would be the case?
I think.
And you prevailed in the prior trial, it's now a mistrial, and you go to use the same piece of evidence and introduce it, and there's an objection, and your response would be, Your Honor, in the previous trial you've allowed this, so...
Well, I would certainly argue that it had been allowed in the previous trial. It had not been objected to.
So you want to use what I hear is that there's some benefits to the first trial that you want to be able to use, except for the being stopped from arguing that it never happened.
Well, again, the evidence and documents that have been exchanged between counsel and exhibits that have been exchanged have been
But it's the admissibility is what I'm talking about, not necessarily whether they each party knows about, you know, have discovered it. That's not the question.
Yeah, but I can only speak to my experience, judges, that a lot of times after a mistrial, I've not been involved in very many, fortunately, but you don't always get the same judge, even if you stay in state court. This case was tried to a visiting judge. He may or may not be available for the next time, or we may get a different visiting judge. In fact, Judge Winkler, who had this case and submitted to a visiting judge, he had made a number of rulings that Judge Niehaus didn't follow, and they were redone. That happens in every case. I don't believe that is the sort of thing that this court, in this instance, should become entangled with. I think the real question is, from a procedural perspective, the very narrow issue is what happens, what is the procedural posture of a case after a mistrial? And I believe that every jurisdiction that's looked at it, and what makes, quite frankly, common sense to me, is that if it's a nullity, then that trial did not commence. Doesn't mean that everything that's happened in the record has gone away. It just means that there's been no trial. So having had no trial, no trial date set, 41A becomes available again. If you look at Wisconsin particularly and Michigan, they both specifically in their decisions state that after a mistrial it becomes a nullity, therefore the rule that was available to voluntarily dismiss, and they have rules like ours, is available again because there has been no commencement of trial.
Thank you.
And it is a procedural.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I assume I have more than 10 seconds. I think I have about 7 minutes. Thank you. Your Honor, a couple of brief points. Counsel made a very important admission. He talked about how when a plaintiff is dissatisfied with pretrial rulings, before impanelment of the jury, he can walk down to the clerk's office and hand them a handwritten dismissal without prejudice. We agree. And the other thing he said that we agree with is that the reasons for the mistrial do not have an effect on the court's ruling here today. We agree. But both of those statements show why Rule 41 has this very bright line language of before commencement of trial. It doesn't say before commencement of a trial that ends in a mistrial, or before commencement of a trial that gets all the way to the jury.
But one of your arguments has been that in a mistrial, you can then go back and use any evidence, exhibits, et cetera, from the first trial. You can do that in every single mistrial, correct?
Absolutely.
So it doesn't matter if they caused it, didn't cause it, they dismissed and refiled. When you have a mistrial, you get an automatic right to a new trial, and all that comes in anyway. So that's sort of a moot point.
Well, the point I think we're trying to make, Your Honor, is it was in addressing the nullity issue. What's important here and why you have the bright line is before commencement of trial, the plaintiff has this unilateral right. Once trial is commenced, the trial judge, who has now sat through the trial, sat through jury selection, evidence, made rulings, seen strategy, knows who may not be at fault, is in the best position to determine the equities and whether dismissal without prejudice should be granted or not. That's why the rule has a bright line. Before
trial
commences.
Well, counsel, the purpose of the rule seems to me the principal purpose of the rule and the use of it is roll up to a trial, and all of a sudden, one side or the plaintiff's expert witness isn't available. Happens a lot, and they use it that way. That's sort of what happened here too. Is that there's an issue of whether or not the expert is going to be the expert's testimony is going to be in or out. So the use is that it was employed here is seems to me to be the same use that it's usually employed for. And we're quibbling about a rule in which the question is, should we read it as saying before the beginning of a trial or before the beginning of the trial? Because the trial is the trial that goes to completion and matters are all resolved. A trial could be a trial that ends up in a mistrial. So we're really asked to figure out which it is.
Well, I think, Your Honor, the definition of commencement of trial is impaneling of the jury and the jury being sworn. It doesn't say in the rule, and you've taken so many witnesses, you've gotten to the end. It simply says the jury has been impaneled and sworn, and at that point, trial commences. That's what every Ohio appellate court has said. Plaintiffs have been unable to cite anywhere in the rule or any case that says trial has not commenced when the jury has been impaneled and sworn, and they've not cited to a single case that says a mistrial means that the original trial did not, in fact, commence. That's the issue for us here.
Well, can you cite us a single case where it's a mistrial and 41A was not permitted?
Your Honor, not a single plaintiff in Ohio that we can find has ever had the audacity to try this. And the reason is 41A2 exists
for a reason. So there's no case going either way.
That's right. So they took a tactical gamble that the rule as written, the plain and unambiguous language, and this Court, implying strict construction, has never read into it a nullity or an exception for a mistrial. They took the gamble. They've admitted they did research and could find nothing that supports the position they took. Under 41A2, that's why the authority to make the determination about whether a case gets dismissed without prejudice rests with the trial judge. After commencement of trial, after the expense to the parties and the court and the jury panel and everyone else, they're in the best position. It doesn't mean they don't get their case dismissed without prejudice. It means they have to go to the trial court and seek it. Your Honor, I'd like to defer the balance of my time to Mr. Mace.
Yeah, please the Court. Damon Mace on behalf of TRW Vehicle Safety Systems. Your Honors, if we look back at the policy behind the rule and at the trend across the United States, it helps us answer the question that Justice Pfeiffer put to us. And it is the trial, commencement of the trial, the first trial. Let me mention four of the policy reasons. First, waste of judicial resources. As this stack of paper represents, that's just the briefing. Judge Niehaus took the time to resolve more than 100 trial-related motions as part of this trial. We had more than a week of jury selection. We had more than a week of testimony at trial. Once trial begins, a party should not be able to unilaterally pull the rug out from under all the trial judge's hard work. It's a waste of judicial resources that he could have been trying another case. Second, a party should not be allowed to use Rule 41A to judge shop or jury shop after the commencement of trial. There are 13 other states, actually Ohio's the 13th, there's 13 total states that have Ohio's type of rule. Although our legislative history isn't as clear, if you look at some of the other states, the reason for that bright line rule is you can judge shop before the commencement of trial, but not after the commencement of trial, not once the judge starts making bright line rules.
Well, when you say judge shop, you're suggesting 41A is a rule that we've put in place to enable judge shopping. I didn't really think that was the purpose of the rule at all.
What I'm suggesting, Your Honor, is that part of the policy behind it is to prevent judge shopping. The rule that the plaintiffs are asking for would allow them to judge shop right up until forever, basically.
But you again characterize the rule as a judge shopping rule. I don't think that's the purpose of it at all.
Well,
it may be employed that way sometimes.
Okay,
but this court surely would not put a rule in place to facilitate judge shopping. It's there for another reason.
Right, but it's to prevent. I misspoke, Your Honor. I didn't make myself clear. It's to prevent judge shopping. That's part of the reasons behind it. Third, the prejudice to other parties. As shown here, the parties in this case spent hundreds of thousands of dollars getting ready for this trial and putting on this trial. Witnesses now are not available who were available 2 years ago. We had employees who left our employ. They're no longer on our payroll. 41D is very limited in the costs you can get. They may say, well, you could just file under 41D to get your costs of the prior action. Ohio has a very narrow rule of that. Some of the other states don't. They allow you to get attorney's fees. Ohio doesn't. The trial court should have the ability to determine what rulings survive and what rulings don't survive. This case is now 2 years stale, all because of the tactics that have been employed. And the fourth policy is that the party should not be able to sidestep an appeal. If you're not happy with the rulings the trial judge is making, you ought to take an appeal in the ordinary course. That's what the law is. You shouldn't be able to say, I don't like the rulings, I'm going to file 41A and get a do-over in a different court. The new trial date, a question had come up, was a new trial date set? A new trial date had not been set, but Judge Niehaus had issued an order, Justice O'Donnell, on the retrial, saying that some of the rulings were going to apply. He had started out laying out guidelines. He had set a status conference for October 19th, 09, to set a new trial date.
There was a pretrial order out?
A pretrial order on retrial. He called it retrial pretrial order, I think. Retrial amended pretrial order. It was filed on July 9 of 09, and it was starting to set out the mechanisms for the retrial. The other thing that hasn't been mentioned, Your Honors, is that TRW had filed a potentially dispositive motion. We had filed a motion to dismiss to exclude all of Mr. Meyer's design testimony, because he had never designed anything. That was pending. Instead of filing an opposition to that, the plaintiffs filed their notice. The Illinois statute that was raised, and that is really the only case that even is anywhere arguably close, but it's distinguishable, as Ms. Wright points out. Under the Illinois, they both have a Supreme Court rule and their civil rule. You can only do it by motion. If there's a dispositive motion pending, that has to be ruled on. And it specifically says in the Illinois Supreme Court rule, the party doing that cannot avoid orders, and the court can award costs, attorney's fees. It gives the greater relief that Ohio doesn't provide. I think the trend should also be considered. When you look at the trend of the law across the United States over the past 40 years, the courts have been restricting the use of 41A, unilateral voluntary dismissals without prejudice, because of the abuses that can occur. Back in the day of notice pleading and writs, and there were a lot of hoops that had to be jumped through, there were some good reasons supporting the rule that no longer exist. So there have been restrictions. This court has commented in some concurring opinions and dissents about the abuse of Rule 41. Ohio is already much more liberal than more than 30 states and all of the federal courts.
Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decisions.